This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Picture your brain as an atlas, a collection of maps. On the program today, we'll talk about the body maps of the brain. They chart the body, the space around the body, and the wider world. Science writers Sandra Blakesley and Matthew Blakesley are our guides this afternoon. The mother and son are the authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better. In the book's introduction, the Blakeleys tell readers the science of body maps has far-reaching applications. It can help people lose weight and make peace with their bodies, improve their ability to play a sport or influence people, and recover from a stroke. It points the way to new treatments for anorexia, phantom limbs, musician's cramp, and a condition among golfers called the yips. It helps explain out-of-body experiences, auras, placebos, and healing touch. And that's just for starters. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited this afternoon. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Sandra Blakesley is a regular contributor to the New York Times, who specializes in the brain sciences. She is the co-author of several books, including Phantoms in the Brain and On Intelligence. Matthew Blakesley is a freelance science writer. The Body Has a Mind of Its Own is his first book. Sandra and Matthew come from a family of science writers. Mother Sandra Blakesley is a third-generation science writer. Son Matthew is the fourth. The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better is published by Random House. And for more on our guests and the book, you can visit the website www.thebodyhasamindofitsown.com. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, we're familiar with roadmaps and atlases. When we speak of body maps, how close does that analogy come to what's going on inside of us? Are we speaking literally of maps?
Yes. Very simple. Like a roadmap, you know, is a point-to-point correlation between a place on the on the land and a map. So your brain contains a sprawling network of maps, and they do carry out different functions. But I think the closest to the atlas is literally your what's called your homunculus, which is your body map based on the sense of touch. So if you touch your arm, you have an arm area that activates your arm area in your brain. You have a little swath of tissue running from the top of your head down to your ear, where your body is laid out in arms, legs, toes, feet, you know, hip, back, thigh, and there's swaths of tissue, just like on a roadmap, that respond to touch on that body part. Right in front of that is a motor map, so when you wave your arm or wave your fingers or do any kind of motor act, there's a map of these motor actions, again, laid out in a, like a little man draped out in the brain, or woman, if you will. There's maps for your felt body sense. There's maps for your for mirror neurons, for mapping other people. There's maps for balance. And all these maps, sort of maps for spatial orientation, and these maps all work together to keep you kind of interacting with your world and your action space. There's a map of space around your body called your peripersonal space. If you put your hand out in front of your body and wave it up over your head and down to your side, all of that space that you're waving your arm through is mapped in your brain. Mm. It's affixed to your body, almost like a halo around your body.
And how are all these maps able to work together?
Well, that's a big question in neuroscience. You have literally dozens of these maps that we've discovered. Some of them are really large, like your homunculi. Some of them are very small, but they're still maps because they have different regions of your body mapped next to one another. But exactly how they interact is still, frankly, a mystery. They're making lots of progress on pieces of the question all the time.
And the two of you have offered readers a helpful analogy of the brain's network, the mandala.
Yeah, we called it the body mandala, just as a shorthand for talking about all these maps that are linked together because they serve so many functions, and yet they come together so tightly under normal circumstances that you feel like you're a unitary individual conscious at a point in time with a fixed number of limbs and other body parts at a fixed point in space, and you grok your surroundings and what you can do, your potential to act. Sometimes when these maps lose their coherence, whether it's just a little temporary glitch that anyone can experience, or whether it's because of a stroke or age-related degeneration or what have you, things can go pretty spectacularly wrong and become pretty Alice in Wonderland-y.
Yeah, people can have three arms, three legs. They can want to cut off their limbs. They can feel like they've got grotesque body parts. Anorexia is one of these conditions where people have this. They look in the mirror, and they're just, painfully thin, starving to death, and they actually literally see themselves as fat. And that's because there's an abnormality in the parietal lobe, which is where this vision and touch come together. All sorts of bizarre things can happen. You can have out-of-body experiences. They're pretty common when you get an insult to an area called the temporal parietal junction, which is in one of these areas where your body comes together in space. And if you have a stroke, or if you even hit that area with an electrode, or if you even tweak it with virtual reality, which they can do, you will leave your body. You can think that a rubber hand belongs to you. You can have a shrinking waist. You can have Pinocchio's nose. The whole sense of being, unitary, as Matt just said, is really pretty much an illusion. It's amazing that we kind of hold together because these maps are like labile, if you will, or they're very prone to morph and change. So phantom limbs is a mapping problem. When you lose an arm, there is plasticity going on in the brain, and it remaps these body areas, and so that you get the sense of a phantom. So we talk a lot about these phenomena in healthy people and in people that have been injured.
Yeah. What neuroscientists are learning now about the body and its mind, if you will, are there things on the horizon that will help people when things get out of whack?
Absolutely. There's areas, people now are working with stroke, with amputees. One area is brain-machine interface, which is reading a body map. It reads the motor map, and you put it into a machine, and then you can hopefully restore sort of normal feedback with a prosthetic limb. There's a lot of work with that. With stroke patients, they're using motor imagery. We talk about motor imagery quite a bit in the context of sports. And this is, you have this motor cortex, which is when you learn a physical skill, like walking with a child, but when you learn tennis or skiing or anything like that, or a musical instrument, you're laying down a finely honed motor map. The research shows that if you use motor imagery, which is to imagine doing the activity, imagine hitting the tennis ball, not visualizing yourself as with your mind's eye, but with your mind's body, you're actually thinking about physically doing the sport, that will increase your motor map. It'll actually add gray matter to your motor map. It increases your skill. They use this for stroke patients that have a little bit of vestigial or leftover movement capacity, and by working on these on this motor imagery, they're able to regain function, some function. I mean, it's still early on,
yeah.
But you can use it in a lot of different ways.
One amazing aspect of that is about the use of this for stroke rehabilitation is that some of the techniques they're discovering and employing effectively now could have been done even in antiquity. They're very low tech, but it was just always assumed that the adult brain is pretty much congealed into its permanent configuration after adolescence, and when it's damaged, tough luck, you know, you've got to find other ways to cope. So stroke patients were given rehabilitative therapy for a certain period, and then it was assumed, okay, they've made as much progress as they can. But just with motor imagery and certain other techniques we describe, they can make a lot more progress, and there's probably more on the horizon as they learn how to apply the principles of neural plasticity and imagery.
Yeah. In healthy people, how dynamic are these body maps, and how elastic are they?
Very. I mean, if you learn a sport, or let's say you learn a musical instrument, mm-hmm. and you're a young adult or a kid, let's say you're playing the violin, and you've got a bow hand and you've got a fingering hand. The motor map for your hand, right? You're literally your hand mapping your brain for the fingering will increase in size as you learn to play the instrument. And in professional musicians, the hand map for the fingering and violinist is larger than the bow hand. Anytime it's you use it or lose it, you know. And if you use something, you're going to beef up the map and make it larger, and you're going to actually change the connectivity to when the movements become very automatic, it moves down the motor cortex to where you don't have to think about it anymore. When you're first learning a skill, you have to kind of concentrate. But once you learn it, you are using a more primitive part of your motor cortex. What can happen in normal people is they get things called dystonias, which is musician's cramp. And piano players and oboists and a lot of professional musicians, not a lot, but some, like 5%, will develop the inability to, let's say, make the fingering movements on the guitar or banjo or violin. Their hand is fine. They can move their fingers, but what's happened is that the finger maps in their brain have fused. So the finger representations in the cortex have actually become commingled. And the way you treat it is you have to splint the fingers and separate the fingers, and then you redrive the separation of the fingers in the brain, in the brain map. And so this works for some people, but it's a new technique for musician's cramp.
Hmm. And what's up with the yips?
Yips is the same thing. It's a golfer's condition. A lot of golfers, and more than will admit it. I mean, I've talked to a lot of golfers, and my brother has the yips, which I first heard about it. And this is the inability to putt. And they step up, and they've been putting for decades, and suddenly they miss. And the usual explanation is that it's anxiety. It's clutching. But another explanation is that it's a frozen body map or a mixed-up body map for a highly over-practiced skill, which can happen with any over-practiced skill.
Oh, okay. So is that the explanation, that it's overdoing?
Yeah, it's over-practiced. It's, the actual stance for putting is very precise, and you do it over and over and over and over again. So the muscles that you use each time are the same. And just like imagine playing the violin, you know, using the same muscles for that fingering. And what can happen is that the muscles, the groups of muscles that are called into action, can get some sort of, this is not the muscles themselves, this is the map of the muscles, the motor map, becomes fused or confused or blended. And you have to then figure out a way to separate that map. It's an abnormal body map.
Yeah. Dancers talk about muscle memory. Is this something that can strike anyone who is doing something over and over and over again?
Yeah, certain professions are more prone to it than others, and the treatments they're coming up with are more effective for some professions, dystonias, than others.
And I wonder if, you know, well, the two of you are writers, you know, I mean, think of being at the keyboard and how automatic that is.
There's a writer's cramp. But dancers will sometimes, if they're injured, sort of lie on the floor during the practice and run the steps with their fingers because they're practicing. They're doing motor imagery. Motor
in their
practice.
Mind's bodies, that's right.
Right, and that can keep their skill level right up there. A lot of great pianists did that. They would just lay their hands on the keyboard and imagine playing. And if you do that in your mind's, in your body's mind, I think John McCain did that when he was in prison in Vietnam.
Mm.
I think it was golf. I can't remember, but he did a lot of imagery and was, and with there was one case of a violinist who was in jail for 7 years and imagined playing the violin every single day for hours and hours and hours. And when he got out of jail, he could play just as well as before going in.
Also with training, skill acquisition, skill honing, and a lot of sports and other physical skills, they're finding that actually combining imaginal practice, motor imagery, with real practice on the court or in front of the keyboard or what have you is superior to just physical practice by itself.
Science writers Matthew Blakeslee and Sandra Blakeslee are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. They are the authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi there. Actually, I just called in to just say thank you for writing such a wonderful book. I have enjoyed it so much, and I've purchased it for my staff. I'm someone who does manual therapy for pain relief, and just that book just frames that paradigm in such a different way. It's just been so powerful, and I have been sort of obsessed with it over the last few weeks, so I just about jumped out of my seat when I heard you on the radio today, because it's such an important contribution. That for me really started with the first book, Phantoms in the Brain, which just was amazing, and this just follows that theme up. So mostly I called just to say thank you for a wonderful contribution.
Thank you. Celeste, could I say something now about that? Because I'm so pleased with that. We have a chapter in this book, it's the last one. It's about your body map, called your interoceptive map. Mm-hmm. And this is a very new concept in neuroscience. And the idea is that you've got these special receptors in your skin, not for touch, just for the standard pressure of touch, but you have receptors for things like heat, cold, tickle, itch, sensual touch, the kind of touch you give to a lover or to a baby, and for pain. And that, and also you have receptors in your internal organs, in your liver, your heart, your lungs, your guts, and that information is funneled up into the brain. And in humans, it is uniquely taken to a region called the insula, actually the right frontal insula. There's a new cell type that's really evolved in humans to take this information and to what they call re-represent it as social emotions. So your sense of shame, guilt, embarrassment, lust, disgust, all of those social emotions are quintessentially human and are represented in this particular part of the brain from this body map, this map of your felt state of your body. Usually, if you're healthy, your body is in what they call homeostasis. It's in balance. And the autonomic nervous system is this two-branched nervous system. And so the information is coming from your heart and your liver and your lungs and your skin from these special receptors. And you're healthy and you're okay. But chronic pain, a lot of conditions, about half of doctor visits are what they call for somatoform disorders, which are things that doctors can't diagnose. And it's probably because this interoceptive map is out of balance. And alternative and complementary medicine, and it gets criticized a lot, but a lot of those techniques are aimed at restoring balance to this interoceptive system. And that's what massage does, it's what acupuncture does, it's what slow breathing does, it's what Tai Chi does. All of those are aimed at the restoration of homeostasis in this map. And it's phenomenal new work.
May I make a comment about that? Sure. A couple years ago, my organization, we were involved with a study with the University of Illinois looking at massage therapy and anxiety and depression. And we looked at a couple different things. One, does it help? That's one question. And the second question was rather interesting, which is it the work itself, you know, the actual physical massage stuff that makes a difference, or is it just merely sort of the social engagement that happens, which would make it not that unlike psychotherapy in that sense, because you're talking and discussing and those sorts of things. So we randomized them into two groups, one of which was limited conversation and one of which sort of encouraged it or didn't discourage it. Myself and the other researchers thought that, of course, it would be the social engagement thing that would show the stronger results. In fact, it was the talk restrictive group that actually had the greatest results in terms of their effects in terms of improving anxiety and depression, which was striking to us. But actually, this whole idea of the introceptive system, now it actually makes perfect sense.
Exactly. It's starting to make a lot of things like that suddenly make sense.
Yeah, and that's what's so exciting about all of this, is that it gives us some framework for understanding, all of these things, and that's what's just why it's such an important thing, and to understand it more deeply is just a great time. So, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Next, we take another call from Champagne Line 2. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was really enjoyed the previous comment. I happen to know that guy well, and I also enjoyed your response that included a comment about Tai Chi. As I heard you talking about this, I really just connected totally with it in the way that I relate to my Tai Chi students as I teach and use imagination and imagery to teach people to become in touch with their body, and not just their body, but the space around their body. And, I haven't read the book, and I intend to get it to help me explain, in other ways this. I'm very aware in the practice of Tai Chi of the integration of not only your body, but the space around it.
Yeah, the space belongs to you, and it is actually, it's as you move your limbs through that space, or as other people enter that space, it's firing neurons out in your parietal lobe. And this is one thing that a lot of people, again, in kind of the alternative medicine world, will talk about energy fields and so on and so on. Western medicine, Western science, has never been able to prove the existence of energy fields as they are discussed in the Eastern traditions.
Yeah.
But this body mapping, this peripersonal space mapping function that is now being described in the neuroscience world,
yeah,
explains it through a Western view. Mm-hmm. You're not imagining it when you feel a presence, like in Reiki, and in healing touch. We talk about that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
This space is literally yours, and when people enter it, it's not that the space is real, it's that the activity in your brain is reacting to your actions, your activities in that space.
Yeah.
So it's like another way of looking at a lot of these traditions, and Tai Chi is just a beautiful example of that.
Yeah, that's great, really exciting. Also, the role of meditation, again, I know there have been some Western studies showing the Dalai Lama in particular was involved with some researchers, I think, at University of Wisconsin, where they actually showed that quieting the mind through meditation actually produces measurable changes, not only in the activity, but in the brain mass itself.
It increases the insula, this structure I just talked about.
Yeah,
it increases the gray matter in the insula.
Yeah, well, it's really exciting, and I enjoy hearing you. I'll hang up and listen to some more.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. Maybe before we go to our next call, you might talk briefly about how these maps are shaped by culture.
Matt, you
want to
do that?
Sure. Yeah, so we're all raised in different cultures with different norms. One example that's pretty striking is with peripersonal space. That's the bubble of space around your body, which as Sandy was just describing, is represented quite literally along with your body. Your body, your brain feels like it belongs to your body. The comfort zones, the bubbles around ourselves, that where we draw distinctions between where we'll let a lover or a child in, or a best friend or an acquaintance we're haggling with, something like that, those vary from culture to culture. One culture might be 12 inches, which might feel awfully close. One might be 18 or 20 inches. And this can lead to misunderstandings. There are lots of stories in anthropology where one person is trying to stand at an amiable distance to have a conversation, and the other, often the anthropologist, or the narrator, is backing away, feeling uncomfortable, not sure why it's happening for a while. And they just can't get their space maps in sync.
Very interesting.
And Asians and Western societies have very different views. Some cultures actually posit the existence of space. There's a group called the Himba in Africa that have a word, and they have they recognize that there's a bubble of space, and they never feel alone, and they feel infinitely sorry for people in the West because we can be alone, and they're never alone because they realize that they're sharing this group space.
Yeah, we see ourselves as points in space, and that's how they put it, whereas they have this distinct concept of merging and sharing this bubble.
Let's take that next call now. A listener in Indianapolis on line 3. Hi.
Hi. I find this very fascinating, and you've talked about the restoration of homeostasis in the body, but I'm wondering if you've looked at or thought about in this whole thing using this to enhance memory, because currently I'm studying for an important exam, and I find that using some of the textbooks that I've used to say about forming mnemonics and consolidating memories and so forth, it just isn't working. So I'm wondering if this could in some way be applied to help me be a better student.
I think memory, I don't know. I mean, there are traditions, there are tricks for memory, you know, they call it the memory, the palace of the memory, where you imagine a house and you have objects and you're remembering facts by walking through the house. This is really about body maps, and I don't know. Matt, can you think of an application for memory?
That's hard to say, because memory is one of those systems, same as body maps, that is interconnected with so many other things. There are bound to be lots of interactions. I don't know how to answer it directly. The thing that occurred to me immediately on hearing the question was when you meditate and use similar techniques to sort of get in touch with your physicality and your emotions and to calm and center yourself, you are, among other things, reducing stress. And stress definitely has a negative impact on memory.
It also impacts concentration.
Mm-hmm. That too.
Yeah. The listener want to follow up?
Well, I agree with you about the aspect of stress and concentration, but I guess I'm optimistic to think that we can in some way apply this, and I have to read your book and think a bit more about it, and thank you for your consideration.
Sure. There's lots of applications, and maybe we haven't thought of that one yet, because this information, as it comes in, can be exploited in many, many ways.
Yeah, sorry we don't have a ready answer, but it's definitely worth exploring.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon to talk with our guests, Sandra Blakeslee and Matthew Blakeslee. They are the authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Are body maps something all living creatures have?
To some degree or another, yes, but ours are far more sophisticated. We still have a lot of body maps in our lower brain, below the cortex, in the brainstem and midbrain areas, but in mammals that have the neocortex, which is this very expanded region, we have body maps, visual maps, auditory maps. So all mammals, all animals map their bodies in some way and map space in some way. But there's almost nothing like us under the sun.
But it varies, you know. Like we talk about raccoons and about
that's interesting.
Pigs and different. Mm-hmm. It depends on how you make your living. Like a rat makes its living with whiskers, and the whiskers are vibrating, and it's sort of making its way through the world. Well, the whisker representation in the rat brain is huge. So each animal will have a large map for how it navigates itself through its senses in the world. So echolocation is one sense. Blind mole rats will use these appendages on their nose. Humans use vision. We have a very large visual cortex. That's sort of our primary sense. But you can be blind and deaf and still get along in the world, but you can't not have a body map. You have to. You can't survive unless you're mapping your body.
Your physical your physical touch and muscular senses are the core of your being.
Well, they're essential for consciousness.
Yeah. It's interesting to see in the book the modeling that has been done, and this gets us back to the homunculus. You know, how different creatures navigate the world, and how their body maps are. You know, in some cases. You know, it's a whisker map, you know, largely, and in other creatures, it's like in humans, there's so much touch in our hands.
Right. Our hands are huge.
Yeah. Hands, mouths, and tongues dominate our homunculi, our touch and motor maps.
Yeah. We've got
the map that is so different in humans, though, is this interoceptive map. It's uniquely mapping the felt sense of the body. And even, you know, dogs don't do that. Monkeys don't do that. Even apes don't do it as much as we do. There's a little bit of evidence that whales have some of this, and elephants have some of this circuitry, and probably parrots, some highly intelligent animals, will have some of this social network of the social circuitry that I'm talking about with the insula. But that map is I think. It's fair to say unique in humans.
Let's take another call or two here. Next, we go to a listener in Oakwood on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I hope I'm able to explain myself here. My blood pressure, I think, went up a little bit, so I'll have to concentrate. It's fascinating, and I look forward to reading your book. The reason I called is because a while back I had a dog bite, and because of that I went through the gamut of physical therapy, such as acupuncture, chiropractor, heat and cold, and so forth. I also ran into a book called Pain Free. I'm starting to quiver here. And also of Rolfing. I'm wondering if you're familiar with Rolfing, because I found this to be just so rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And when the muscle was relieved of the pain, when this Rolfer was able to relieve the pain, there was an experience such as a pimple popping, and I would remember when that injury occurred. I'm wondering if you're familiar with this reaction.
Yeah, and it's, talk about it in a couple of ways in the book. First of all, that kind of a fear, pain with fear, is represented in the insula. It's not actually represented in the touch cortex. It's in this area that I talked about.
It was fascinating.
But there's this is so new. A lot of people that work with pain and with pain like you're describing from the dog bite, but also a lot of sort of psychological pain. Let's say you were abused as a child or were in an automobile accident. A lot of that kind of anxiety and pain can be held in the body, and it's in the insular cortex. The way to release it can be Rolfing. Somatic psychology is another fairly new line of psychology where the therapist doesn't do talk therapy to say, do you remember when you were five and whatever. But what they'll do is they'll talk about your felt body sense. How does your body feel right now? Where is it tight? Where is it cold? Where is it hot? And they'll walk through this titrate, this felt body sense, and very often be able to help the patient release that held memory and that held tension and that held fear.
And it's immediate.
Yeah, it happens. It just pops. Yep.
And because of the Ralphing experience and the book called Pain Free, I'm now able to relieve my pain through the day going through certain routines that I've learned without pain pills.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And I'm so very, very thankful of that because I know I would be looking for those pain pills because I did in the beginning. You look for relief. And, mm-hmm. of course, there's so many side effects. And with the physical therapy, if it's learned properly, and I feel so blessed to be able to explain this to you.
Yeah. You know, pain is very often an opinion on the state of the body. The pain is not in the periphery. The pain is not in your lower back, or the pain is not in your shoulder, or in the wrist that was broken a year ago and still feels pain. I have a knee that I injured, and I still feel pain in it. I know the knee is completely healed up, but the pain is represented elsewhere, and it's in the brain tissue. And so you're not going to get at relieving the pain by manipulating the knee or the lower back. You're going to have to get directly into the brain.
And one does that how?
Various ways. Again, by restoring this sort of homeostasis, restoring this balance in the autonomic nervous system. And there's dozens of techniques. You mentioned one, but there's a meditation also. A lot of the alternative complementary medical techniques will do that. There's a thing called real-time fMRI used for chronic pain. This is a fMRI machine. It's the one where they use to put your head in a magnet and they're looking where the blood is flowing.
Oh, yes.
They've taken patients with chronic pain and they put them in the scanner and they have they show them a flame. And the flame, and they're looking at their insula, and the insula is overactive. And so they're in the scanner, and they see a picture of a flame, and they're told to quench the flame any way you can, just to use your imagination to think how you could dampen that flame. So people talk about throwing snowballs at it, a fire hose, you know, or whatever. And when they do that mental imagery around reducing the size of that flame, the pain goes away.
Fascinating. I look forward to reading your book, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Thank you for sharing.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
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 Hello. I guess I have you. Can I hear you?
Yeah, we've got you. Go ahead.
Oh, all right. I have what they call Alzheimer's disease. I'm almost 80, and I had to move away from a beloved community to be here near my daughter because she... a nurse, and I volunteered the family to care for me. But I have no friends, and not been able to form any kind of social connections. I think it's because I don't have a memory, and I could, you know, I could meet somebody, but not remember their name, and not remember how to get a hold of them. But I have tried. I've been here over a year, and I had met some women my age, and I'm 80. And I sent them Christmas cards with notes of five different people that I'd met casually, and none of them responded. So now I'm totally alone except for my contact with my daughter, who's a nurse and who's very good to me.
You remember her, right?
What?
You remember her.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, of course. I do. I think mainly my memory problems are with things that happen currently. I have a good memory of my background and of my family, my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. So, well, this is not so much a body mapping problem, but I could say something about it in the terms of the brain has different functional areas. In Alzheimer's type dementia, there is a loss of memory from the hippocampus, which is an area where you're navigating in space, and short-term memories are hard to form.
Yes.
But many Alzheimer's patients actually become more social as that particular part of the brain disconnects because it's got a disorder. It's got a proteins are misfolding and gunking it up. Then other areas of the brain will become actually enhanced. And one of the things about Ronald Reagan when he was president, he actually had Alzheimer's when he was president, and he was, you know, Mr. Affable, Mr. Nice Guy,
yeah.
Because his social skills were actually increased because of the Alzheimer's.
Yes.
So, and there's other disorders where you'll lose something about in the frontal lobes. There's a dementia that Pete Domenici has right now, one of our senators. And that with that, a certain type of that disorder, people become artists. They become beautiful landscapers. They get a artistic capacity because another part of the brain increases in its function.
Yes, I think I might come to under that category to a certain extent because I've always liked to do some doodling and coloring and painting and drawing. And I am doing that because I'm alone all the time. But, yeah, my problem is, of course, that people here aren't interested in befriending somebody who's mentally, you know, deficient as I am. And so I have no friends. And I mean, I know you can't solve that, but I just wondered, if there's something I could do that would help me, help my memory.
That's really not in the realm of what we're talking about in our book. There is a lot of work on Alzheimer's, which I follow, but there's no good treatments for it right now.
Yeah.
Sorry to say.
In a person with Alzheimer's, does the desire for social connection increase?
It can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because what happens is, as one area of the brain disconnects, other areas, because you lose the dominance. So usually the left hemisphere dominates the right hemisphere. The frontal sections of the brain, the frontal lobes, will dominate from the posterior segments. If you get a disconnection in one area, then it can actually free up and unmask or increase activity in another area.
Yeah.
And this is a connectivity question, and it's very new and it's fascinating. They're beginning to study connectivity and with brain diseases. So you can release creativity, you can release sociability with some of these disorders.
Yeah.
It's not a mapping question, per se. It's
right.
Not a body mapping question, but it's more about how the brain is connected
yeah.
up.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and those of us who are listening this afternoon now, maybe if we connect with someone like our caller, we'll be a little bit more understanding about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, in reference to the previous caller, I think this community may have, like, adult day groups, which might be beneficial for that. And I was my question was actually about elderly. Is this process used at all, been tested in elderly groups?
Which process?
The imaging, basically. And so using parts of the body that possibly they no longer can use?
I don't know if it's parts of the body. With age, you get cognitive decline normally.
Of it's just very general.
Yeah, most of it is general. And in the absence of disease, you get mild cognitive decline. But many people are very, like my mother is 90 and she's sharp as a tack. She's incredibly, her mind is, you know, all there. But it's what these disorders are with aging are what are called protein folding disorders. And there's a lot of, you know, proteins that are, with Alzheimer's, it's one particular protein. With Parkinson's, it's another protein. And these proteins become misfolded and, really, literally, gum up the works, and so that these brain regions no longer work, and people lose memory.
One thing that does relate to aging, though, and body mapping, is not just to keep physically fit or active, which we know helps to stave off the mild, normal decline that most people get, but continuing to. Well, not challenge your body in an exercise way, but, for example, walking on uneven surfaces, keeping your balance system
mm-hmm.
challenged to within safe limits. One thing we write about is in China, there are parks with cobblestone all over them that people walk on to keep healthy. And you kind of wonder, well, why would that work? Why would that be? It's just an old folk tradition, maybe. Turns out, though, it makes a lot of sense if you're trying to keep yourself fit and healthy in the long run. Studies in Europe have shown that people who live in older parts of the city who walk on cobblestone and uneven surfaces habitually versus people who have pretty much the same background and lifestyle who live in newer parts of the city where their sidewalks are flat like they are in most places in America. The people who walk on cobblestone keep their balance and agility a lot longer in life, just because the soles of their feet are having to recalibrate and balance, and they have got to keep using their ankles, and that, of course, is using their balance maps and their ankle maps.
Yeah. Right, this is a vestibular map. These maps are all synchronized and come in together, so Matt's right. The walking on uneven surfaces is a really great thing to do. You go hiking, walk on rocks, walk on these pebbles. They're kind of black pebbles, and they're all over China, but you can actually get them in the U.S. And to and get on a balance board, a wobble board at a gym, things like that, will keep your brain young.
Keep in touch with your body's senses.
In the absence of disease.
Yeah. We've got to wrap up here, but before we go, let's talk about at the outset of life. Can you give us an idea quickly about what we can do to promote the development of children's brains and bodies?
Matt should do this because he has a 3-year-old.
Well, let's see. I mean, at the basic level, giving them relatively early training is important if they're going to go on to become masters of a sport or a skill. I mean, nobody takes up piano or skiing in their 40s and goes on to become world class. You have to do that early. Your body maps remain plastic throughout your life, and we're getting better at driving them to change more and in better ways later in life. But there's still nothing to substitute for developing skills early.
Yeah.
Touch is important, too. A lot of touch.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's that, yeah.
And there's this mirror neuron system we haven't even had a chance to talk about.
Yeah.
But parenting, children are just imitators, and they mirror your actions. And so this is kind of a scary thing. Most people know it, that your kids will imitate you.
Yeah, do as I say.
They're absorbing it into their body maps.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. The chapter on mirror neurons is really fascinating, by the way, listeners. So pick up the book, The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better, written by our guests this afternoon, Sandra Blakesley and Matthew Blakesley. The book is published by Random House.